Oh, hello. You weren't expecting me to drop into your podcast feed again, were you? Sorry. It's Stuart Clarkson here. I've just stopped by to bring you an archive interview from back in 2017 that I did for Radio Today with Andy Peebles. Andy died suddenly this week, aged 76. He is, of course, best known for that interview with John Lennon in New York in December 1980, and we talk about that in the interview. But after a long career with Piccadilly, BBC Local Radio, Smooth and Gold, as well as 13 years at Radio 1 in its heyday, he did have a lot of stories to tell. I first worked with Andy at Smooth Radio back in 2006 when I read his news, and he usually couldn't find too much to complain about with my bulletins, and as a result of that, we became friends. In more recent years, we'd go for lunch or speak on the phone. He'd got lots of opinions on today's radio scene and news output, and it was always great to hear Andy's views on life. A call from Andy, and you knew you were in for a story or two or three, and as I'm from Yorkshire, usually a Geoffrey Boycott impression as well. Our thoughts here at Radio Today are with Andy's wife, Anne, and all his family and close friends. It's an absolutely heartbreaking time for him to pass away just so unexpectedly. So here's Andy, in his own words, on his time at Radio 1. We recorded this as the station was about to turn 50 in 2017, and he starts by taking us back to his teenage years in the 1960s.
I have been a massive devotee of pirate radio. I honed in eventually on Radio London merely because my next-door neighbour for 3 years was their chief newscaster, Paul Kay, who became a very dear friend, and unsurprisingly a huge inspiration, made me think this is what I want to do, much to the horror of my mother. My father had died in 1961 when I was 11, so my mother brought myself and my sister up and obviously realised and admitted to me years on that music basically took over my life. I adored pop music, the Beatles, the Stones, all those great 60s groups, and the pirate stations who played their music. But of course, we learnt that the bill was going to come in, the Marine Offences Bill. I once had the opportunity, actually, to tell Tony Benn how much I disliked him, and he roared with laughter. And he said it wasn't entirely my fault. I said, well, you and the MP for Highton on Merseyside, if I could have made dolls of both of you and stuck pins in them, I would have done. Because, you know, the pirates were our best friends. I mean, Tony Windsor every morning, Tony Blackburn, bit of John Peel at night playing Country Joe and the Fish and The Misunderstood and all those extraordinary bands that years on he denied he'd ever played. But that's John Peel. We can talk about him maybe later. So, I knew it was coming, and I went to college in Bournemouth at the beginning of September 1967. And on Saturday morning the 30th at 7 o'clock in the morning, I was ensconced in my bed, but my alarm had woken me up and I had turned on what was going to be Radio 1. And then Paul Hollingdale and Tony Blackburn were rent asunder by technical expertise at the BBC, and we had Radio 1 and Radio 2.
Stand by for switching. Get tuned to Radio 1 or 2, 5, 4, 3. Radio 2, Radio 1, go.
The voice of Radio 1. Just for fun.
Music.
Too much.
And good morning, everyone. Welcome to the exciting new sound of Radio 1.
I listened to Radio 1, and there was our mutual friend, Stuart, Johnny Beerling, sitting in a chair behind Tony as his producer, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yes, indeed, we've even got Arnold back. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first of the Tony Blackburn shows. I shall be waking up every morning, except Sunday, between 7 and 8.30. So let's away!
Woke up one morning, half asleep with our...
As an 18-year-old, was it for you, or was there a little sense that, well, it's nothing going to be like the Pirates because it's the BBC?
Well, the problem was, of course, that the Musicians' Union, who had a very, very tight fist on the whole situation, made life nigh on impossible for the corporation at the beginning because, understandably, I mean, I support musicians wholeheartedly. I wanted to be one at one stage. Thank goodness I wasn't. Bad enough being a broadcaster for 47 years. But in reality, the Jimmy Young Show featuring Jack Emblow's sextet doing their version of Michelle by the Beatles was very definitely what I didn't want to listen to. But they had no option in the early days. It was a long time before the needle time problem was sorted out. I mean, even when I went to Radio 1 in 1978, and we were delighted to do it, of course, we had to have sessions as part of our programme. This was an invitation to a group to go into the Maydevale studios and record covers of their current material or whatever. In my case, one of the first was three gentlemen by the name of Sting, Andy Summers and Stuart Copeland, who did a fantastic version of Roxanne, recorded specifically for our programme. So, yeah, coming back to your point, it wasn't totally what I wanted to listen to, but it had some great moments, notably for me as an aspiring soul fan, Mike Raven's R&B show, and somebody who I'm very proud to call a friend, Michael Pasternak, better known to all of us as Emperor Roscoe, who became a friend and was one of my great mentors, but had the most extraordinary taste in music. And his show was quite brilliant. And John Dunn, I remember berating him years on, was very naughty when he said, and now the news in English, on the first day of Roscoe's broadcasting, because he was screaming and doing all the great Casaboo stuff, which we all loved. He was terrific.
And when you were lying in your bed listening to Tony Blackburn on that first morning, did you ever think you'd be on that radio station one day?
No, and more than that, Stuart, I didn't think I'd become a good friend of Tony's, and I'm saying that with some confidence. I think we are good friends. We don't see each other that much, but he was another mentor to me. I remember Johnny Beeling saying to me, is it true that you've been sitting in the studio while Tony's been on air? And I said, yes, why? He said, well, he never lets anybody in the studio. He tells people to go away. He can't stand having people in the studio. Tony was very kind, very benevolent, very helpful to me. And watching him work, because his hands went faster than Concord, one of the greatest operators of a broadcasting panel I've ever seen. I think he and Noel Edmonds and Roscoe would be my top three in terms of technical expertise. But I learned a great deal watching him, and it was a joy.
So from Bournemouth, you moved to Manchester, you got on the BBC local radio station there, and then Piccadilly when it launched in 74, a successful few years at Piccadilly. How then did that move to Radio 1 come about? Did you go to them? Did they come to you?
Well, the joy of Piccadilly, of course, was that it was run by Philip Birch, who'd run my beloved Radio London, the pirate station. So it was fantastic working for him for 4.5 years. After about three and a half, I got a strange phone call. Well, I say strange. It was very clandestine. It was very MI5. And it basically said, we're listening to you. We're interested in what you're doing. This phone call does not constitute an offer of any kind. It was all a bit like that. I'm not exaggerating that much. It involved a great character called Tony Hale, who eventually phoned me up and said, right, Johnny Beeling's coming to Manchester. He'd like to take you out for dinner. Please don't presume or assume that this means you are being offered a job. But why else would he be coming to Manchester? Or words to that effect. And we went to Blinker's Bistro. I'll never forget it. And I spent a great deal too much time doing my very lukewarm impression of Alan Freeman. And Johnny was laughing because, you know, great guy. And Johnny said to me, look, we have been monitoring you. I've been getting tapes of your soul shows sent to London. We like what we hear. And it is very likely that within the next couple of months, you will be hearing from Derek Chinnery and Doreen Davis, which I duly did. They invited me to London. We went out for lunch. I jumped back on the train, went back to Piccadilly, having been told by them that they were going to offer me a job. And you will know, Stuart, that that job was to bridge the gap between 7:30 and 10 in the evening, because remarkably, even in those days, Radio 1, well, it didn't close down, but it went to Radio 2 at the end of the first session of the day at around 7 o'clock. And came back for John Peel, isolated as he was, bless him, on his island, between 10 and midnight. So I was the person who was going to bridge that gap, which was all well and good, until the BBC Union in the London control room said, you haven't talked to us about this, and we're not happy. Thank you. We refuse to man the programme. So for the first 3 or 4 months of my time at Radio 1, oh dear, Tony Hall's not going to like me for this, I was basically paid for doing nothing. I'd signed a contract, therefore the BBC had an obligation to pay me. Derek Chinnery must have torn his hair out on a nightly basis and spent most of his time trying to contrive reasons to get me on air. I remember doing a special on 10cc. I did New Year's Eve, 78 into 79.
1979. Across the nation. 275 and 285. Andy Peebles.
on Radio 1.
And may I be the first to wish you a very, very happy new year. 1979 is here, but in 1978 it had to be the year of the Bee Gees.
I did a couple of other programmes, and then eventually Derek had had enough. The union relented and said, right, we'll man the show. But in the meantime, he put me on in the afternoon, which meant Tony Blackburn lost airtime. David Jensen, Kid Jensen, lost airtime. I wasn't very popular with either of them, but they were both very friendly and understood. And I did a programme which I think was an hour and a half a day for a period of time, and then eventually on to the evening show.
Nick Straker and his band and a walk in the park. Good idea on a day like this. And if you're taking your transistor to listen to Richard Skinner, don't turn it up too loud, will you? Have a great weekend. I'll see you tomorrow afternoon for Rock on Saturday. It's 4:30 on a Friday afternoon. And with the Newsbeat headlines...
And as you say, you were getting some kind of big gigs fairly early in your time at Radio 1, and none less so than Elton John Live from Moscow, which was a BBC first in 79, I think.
Yeah, and absolutely hilarious story, because at that stage, number one, I had never flown anywhere. Number two, I didn't possess a passport. So you can imagine my producer, Jeff Griffin, when I told him, he said, you are joking, aren't you? I said, no. The BBC, through its good offices, seemed to get me a passport fairly quickly. Off we went to a terrifying Russia. I mean, we are talking Cold War. We are talking about walking around a city which, in architectural grandeur terms, was extraordinary to behold. But in reality, I spent the whole time, as did most of our party, looking over our shoulders. It was all very worrying. I mean, our engineering team for that venture, which was a stereo broadcast from the Rossiya Hall in Moscow.
The noise you're hearing in the background at the moment is an explanation to our Russian audience. But what an occasion this is for BBC Radio 1. It's a world exclusive as we bring you Elton John and Ray Cooper live from Moscow. We're all very thrilled about it, and I hope that for the next 2.5 hours or so, we're going to settle back at home in England and enjoy what I can only say will be a superb concert, and that is absolutely guaranteed.
The KGB sent officers who demanded to see the spec and the plans of the equipment which Jeff Griffin, Mike Robinson and the rest of our team were actually using to do the broadcast. The BBC boys said no, and it all got very, very fraught. So whilst I would say that you've cited a little bit of my Radio 1 history, which I loved at doing, particularly because I took a bet with the London control room that I couldn't hit the Greenwich time signal on the nose from Moscow. I actually set my watch, so now you know, boys, I did cheat. I did use a watch, but it was fun, with a 3.5 second delay.
And the programme was produced by Jeff Griffin. This is Andy Peebles in Moscow in the Soviet Union, handing you back to the BBC in London.
I was blessed with some terrific gigs, for want of a better phrase, from a very generous management. I mean, I hope I didn't let them down. There have been debates over the years, and quite right that there should have been, over why was it me who went to New York to do the Lemon interview, which I'm sure we'll come to in due course. You know, Peter Powell could have done that. David Jensen could have done it. John Peel might have done it if he wanted to. There were plenty of other people. So I was very lucky to get the gig. And luck plays and has played a massive part in my 47 years on air.
And that trip to New York in 1980 in December, that was planned to be a comeback interview for Lennon. He'd got a new album out, and it was going to be a 5-part series for Radio 1. Things changed a little bit, knowing what we know now. How were you in the build-up to that trip to New York?
Terrified, nervous, pretty well from the off. I remember going home to my flat in North London and actually standing in the lounge. Well, I sat down on the sofa and I kept saying to myself, you are going to interview John Lennon. What do you think? I mean, I was talking out loud. So you can imagine when they didn't turn up, on the Saturday at 12 midday, as they told us they would, and we had to wait till 10 to 6 in the evening. My stomach was just a turmoil. I mean, butterflies. But an utter thrill, Stuart, because I had, well, yeah, I will use the word, I'd idolised him and his band. I mean, Paul and I have had the discussion. I don't think Paul ever fronted up. We did about 8-9 interviews, probably. And he's lovely, but he never got round to saying, you know, who was your favourite Beatle? I mean, John was my favourite Beatle before I met him. But by that time, I'd interviewed Paul a lot. So the two of them were very special. And I am pretty proud of the fact that I have interviewed Lennon and McCartney, I've interviewed Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, I've interviewed Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel. And before anybody says anything, yes, I know Art Garfunkel didn't write, but he did perform. So those are, you know, three incredible combinations who I was lucky enough to spend time with and talk to.
Do you feel now at this stage that the team and the ease of writing is now back with you? And,
yes.
And that you're going to be extremely prolific in the months and years to come?
Yes, I think it's going to be a one period, they say. Those two will do anything for publicity. Get them off the front page, you know, get them out there. You know, people are bitching at us because we were always doing something, and then they were bitching at us because we weren't doing anything. And I have a funny feeling that it's going to be the other way around again, because we're talking and talking and talking, and all sorts of plans and ideas we have in our head. It's just a matter of getting it done. We already got half the next album, and we'll probably go in just after Christmas and do that.
Looking back now, there were some significant moments in that, particularly where you ask him about his security in New York.
One final question to you. What about your private life and your own sense of security these days? David Bowie, I think, has recently said, but the great thing about New York is that he can walk down the street and people, instead of rushing up and ripping his clothes off, will come out, or rather just walk past him and say, "Hi, David, how are you?" And he
exactly.
can say, "I'm very well." Is it the same for John and Yoko?
Yeah, that's what made me finally stay here. It wasn't a conscious decision. I just found that I was going to movies, going to restaurants.
What made you ask him that?
Well, forgive me for this, Stuart, but the journalist in me. I mean, I had done a lot of interview work. I'd interviewed prime ministers. I'd interviewed a lot of politicians. And whilst I didn't go to official journalist training school, and I wasn't a member of the NUJ, I would like to think that I can keep my wits about me. I'd like to think I'm a reasonably shrewd character. And one thing I am, and I'm proud of this, I think, is an observer of life. So when we arrived at the Dakota on the Friday and two security officers in uniform blazers were standing by the gate, I mean, to say that they were big would be an understatement. You could impart a Chevrolet on their shoulders. They were, I discovered later, I think, retired linebackers from the New York Giants. And you certainly wouldn't have argued with them. And my mind started saying, well, now, hang on. Why are they here? And the answer, of course, was because they were doing an important job. What unfolded in the next couple of days might have underlined the fact that perhaps they weren't doing the job or couldn't be doing the job that they should have been doing. There's been a lot of speculation about what went on. On the Friday, I'm convinced that Mark Chapman was standing with a group of people outside the Dakota. So it could have been, if John had come downstairs and Yoko had come down, which they didn't, that we might have actually seen him and heard him speak. My personal view is I hope he enjoys his life, all of it, in prison, and that he is never, ever released, because I think if he was, he wouldn't last very long. But that's a personal view.
I can go right out this door now and go in a restaurant. Do you want to know how great that is? Mm. Or go to the movies? I mean, people will come up and ask for autograph or say hi, but they won't bug you, you know? They just say, "Oh, hey, how you doing? Like your record," or whatever. You know, that's because we got a record out now, but before they'd shout, "How you doing? You know, how's the baby?" Mm. "Oh, great, thanks. How are you?"
Talking about restaurants,
I'm starving. So what happened to the chicken soup?
John and Yoko, on behalf of us, thank you very, very much for
talking to us. A great pleasure to talk to you and the BBC and all the English and Scots and Welsh and Irish listening. And
cheers.
Hip, hip.
I look back on it as being one very important moment in my career. I did not in any way want it to become what it then became. I had as many detractors as enthusiasts about the whole thing. People said, "Oh, you've only got to mention, you know, his name and he'll talk about it." Oh, no, I didn't. Other people talked to me about it all the time. And because I was brought up, hopefully, to be reasonably polite, if I felt it was relevant, I would respond. You know, I've had a lot of time to think about it. We all have. I had a great friendship with Yoko, which sadly waned. I think I'd served my purpose in her life would probably be one way of putting it. But there you are. And I've got to a stage now where the anniversaries tick by. I went to New York for the first anniversary. I twisted Yoko's arm and asked her whether we could record in the Dakota. She'd never allowed a camera in there before. And I got her in the end to sit down in front of the white piano on which John had played Imagine on that famous video recording at Tittenhurst Park in Ascot. And we came back and Michael Grade, who was he who should be obeyed at the BBC, poured me a glass of champagne and said, thank you and well done. So, yeah, extraordinary times. But, you know, what I would love now, what I wanted then, was for him to still be here and to be making music. Because you're absolutely right. David Geffen, whose record label they had signed to, was desperate to get promotion. I mean, it seems ridiculous saying that about somebody as iconic as John Lennon, but they were in the rat race in December 1980. There were loads of great albums being released, and theirs was one of them. And they had to try and capitalize on the situation and promote the album. Well, fairly obvious thing to say, isn't it? You can't think of a more tragic way of promoting an album. And the cynic in me would say to you, Stuart, would it have got to number one if John hadn't been shot? The answer to that question we will never know.
You talked about your kind of curiosity and wanting to talk to people and kind of have that life conversation with them and not necessarily having the journalistic training. Moving on into the 80s, you then did your Friday night sports show. We had a lot of big sports stars in your My Top 10 programme, interviewing massive stars. Did you see yourself at Radio 1 as a music broadcaster or as a kind of interviewer and speech person as your career developed?
Both. I went to Radio 1 to broadcast music. My biggest buzz, Stuart, is people writing to me as they did in those days. Do you remember letters? It's a long time ago, isn't it? They would write and say, oh, the track you played at 20 past 8 last Friday is just fantastic. Thank you so much. I've been out and bought the album. I got a real buzz out of that. And I'm not saying this for effect. I really did. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to champion great stars. And I was helped, certainly when I was doing daytime programmes at Radio 1, by the fact that we could have a record of the week. I Broke Sailing by Christopher Cross. I can hear loads of people saying, so what? I played it as well. But no, I mean, to get a record of the week on Radio 1 in those days was a very, very big deal. So, yeah, I was passionate about music. I wasn't totally keen on the idea of doing daytime music, and I got quite pushy with my beloved friend Doreen Davis and said to her, do you mind if I play the occasional album track? Johnny Walker and I were cut from the same mould. I just felt that Radio 1 was in danger of getting stuck in a rut because it just literally rotated singles. It did it well, but I thought that there was so much more to music, particularly the album scene by then, that Radio 1 should be doing that. So that was fun and all right. I think I got about 20% of the way in achieving something there. The other side of it, for me professionally, was a joy. I mean, to be able to sit down and to talk to legendary figures from the world of music.
Just so we don't feel completely constricted and trapped within this sort of monster called Queen. So it is nice to go and do those things where you have totally your own say and you get away from the others a bit. But then that makes it better when you come back, really, and work together again.
I presume I'd be start raving bonkers to imply that you're in touch with one or other member of the band every day of your life. I mean, presume there
are
periods.
Not every day, but we're in fairly constant touch with each other about things, you know. I mean, my lawyer talks to their lawyers. No, I'm only joking.
But there is a stage, I'm sure you would admit to me, where the business starts to get too much, where
you
hit the nail on the head. You want to be creative, you want to be artists, you don't want the hassles.
No, but I think we try and isolate ourselves as much as possible.
News of that match, MCC versus the rest of the world. Plus the sporting headlines that matter as we prepare you for another great weekend of sporting action. With the very best of music, it's the programme that Steve Wright never, ever misses.
The Friday night sports programme was Derek Chinnery's idea. We were driving on a week out, a famous Radio 1 week out, and he said to me, you love sport, don't you? And I said, yes. I said, I've done a lot of sports broadcasting. I hosted the sports programme on Piccadilly Radio in Manchester when we opened. So I was pretty happy with doing that. But I never dreamt
but I get to talk to all those incredible people. And it was good timing, really, Stuart, because Ian Botham was just about to become a worldwide star. Billy Beaumont was just about to lead his English rugby team to a Grand Slam. Kevin Keegan, great character, you know, was at the forefront and captaining the England football side. So there were a lot of good people around. And I had the most wonderful producer in Jeff Griffin, an equal sports buff. And we had lots of fun. That was a fantastic programme and one of the real joys of my career.
And another big show that you got to cover on was the Top 40.
Well, Doreen Davis phoned me up and I was in disbelief when she said, I think it was Tony Blackburn, it might have been Simon Bates at the time, was going on 2 weeks holiday. And would I dep? And I said, well, I'd love to. What an honour. And then sort of started visibly shaking with fear.
Michael Jackson drops 5 places on this week's chart, down to number 13 with Wannabe Starting Something from that great album Thriller. And at number 12, the second highest climber of the week, it's gone up 18 places. At one stage, you could find this song on the B-side of Marvin Gaye's version of I Heard It Through the Grapevine. But on this day in 1983, it's at number 12 for Paul Young.
My producer was a legend, the late, great Bernie Andrews. Bernie had produced all the Beatles sessions for Saturday Club with Brian Matthew back in the early 60s. A wonderful, wonderful man. Great friend of my producer, Jeff Griffin. So we all got on like a house on fire. And Bernie had a wonderful, waggish sense of humour. So picture the scene in Continuity B on that Sunday afternoon. We'd done the first hour between 5 and 6, and I knew full well that at 6 o'clock, when the Greenwich time signal went, the good old Pips, that Radio 2 was joining us. That was nothing to do with me. Somebody next door was twiddling knobs and flicking switches, and the two networks joined together, which gave the BBC a fairly large audience. And I'd been aware of this, but I was more concerned in my finger on the button for the next jingle and cueing the next song. So you did numbers 40 to 21 in the first hour and then 20 to 1 in the second. And I noticed while the jingle was playing that Bernie Andrews was frantically scribbling on a piece of A4.
And now here they come, the big one, starting with...
And I hit the jingle.
Number 20.
Opened the microphone, said, new entry this week, number 20, whatever it was. Closed the mic, and as I closed it, I looked up, and Bernie was holding up this piece of A4 on which he had written, bless him, "It may interest you to know, but at this time last week, 24.75 million people were listening to this programme."
And that put the fear of God in you.
I don't think it put the fear of God in me, but it made me realise just how huge the BBC was. It made me realise that the British, or rather the BBC Top 40, was something which really mattered. And then, of course, going on to do Top of the Pops, I saw the other side of, you know, how you promote music. Because there's no doubt about it. The Top 40 in those days was the Bible. How many people recorded it, cutting out the presenter, I hastily add, and why not, so that they got that week's Top 40 for free. Disgraceful, of course. Totally, I'm not supporting this in any way. Totally illegal. They should have been severely punished and made to listen to Simon Bates' Golden Hour for 3 weeks on the trot.
5, I guess that's why they call it the blues, from Elton John. Number 4 this week, Moonlight Shadow from Mike Oldfield and Maggie Riley. And at number 3, Flashdance, What a Feeling from Eileen Cara. And at number 2, after 4 weeks at the top, it's a drop for the Police with Every Breath You Take.
Britain's number 1.
And you've used the word fun quite a lot. Radio 1 in the 80s kind of epitomised that kind of celebrity atmosphere, because the DJs were big stars, they were on television as well, a lot of them, and you had those massive road shows to go out and meet people. So what was it like at Radio 1 in Egton in the 80s?
It was very good. There was the fourth floor. They never opened the records that the record companies sent them. And this is a bit of a cliche, but it's probably half true. And then there was the third floor, on which I was ensconced with my producer, Jeff Griffin, where we were music mad. I mean, if a representative of a record company came in, we would literally grab the brown envelope out of their hands and say, "What's this? What's this?" But the atmosphere was terrific. I never saw myself in footballing terms as part of the Radio 1 Premier League. I was pretty happy to be probably in the middle of the first division. I'm saying that because, I mean, it's self-apparent, isn't it? Noel Edmonds was a national star. He was a huge name. Multicoloured swap shop, etc., etc. Terry Wogan had taken off like the proverbial rocket, left Radio 1, of course. But these people were big television stars. I hated doing Top of the Pops, and it is acutely embarrassing that in recent months, 30-odd years on from their original broadcast, they're rebroadcasting editions on which Robin Nash, Michael Hurl and other producers were mad enough to employ the man with the perfect face for radio.
Yes, pleased to meet you. Let's get underway. Number 36 on the chart this week. They're from Scotland. They're the Bluebells. This is Young at Heart.
And I'm not trying to be self-effacing. I was never comfortable with television. I actually told Robin Nash that he should hire us as voices. I said, if you do that, you'll find you'll be able to fit another record in. But he wouldn't have it. And I suppose, looking back on it, I mean, it was a great catalyst for other work. And the BBC in those days was honest enough to admit that it could never pay us the sort of money that we would earn by doing personal appearances, voiceovers for commercials, and what have you. But the atmosphere at Radio 1 in that decade was, yeah, it was pretty good. And we were a very good team. I don't think there were many arguments. Everybody knows the cliched stories about people who didn't like each other. And I don't really want to go there because it's so hackneyed. It's been in every book. It's been in every story. I will say that I was relieved that they didn't renew my contract at the beginning of 1992, having seen what happened after 1992, when Dear Matthew and Dear Trevor arrived with their axes glinting in the sunlight and cut the place to shreds. And in a way, part of me says, and absolutely right, that they should do that. I mean, I can't relate, for obvious reasons, Stuart, to the current Radio 1. I hear it occasionally. Some of it I quite like. I think Greg James is a terrific broadcaster, but I'm probably biased because we were both brought up in the same town, Bishop Stortford in Hertfordshire, and he, like me, adores cricket. But there are other people on there who I listen to. I'm a huge Trevor Nelson fan. I think the guy is, well, to use the parlance, is really cool, knows his music, and he's very good. But it's poles apart from the Radio 1 that I remember, which is why when we privately celebrate 50 years of Radio 1, the people there will have worked for Radio 1 and the corporation between the years 1967 and 1992. Pure coincidence that that was when I departed. But I departed with incredible memories. I departed with real joy in having had 13 years at the national network. I mean, on that morning, lying in Bournemouth at 7 o'clock, listening to Tony, I think you implied it earlier, I could never, ever have guessed that I was going to have 13 years working there and to meet some really great people, many of whom have remained friends ever since.
And if you could pick out one or maybe three key memories from your time at Radio 1, what would they be?
I think probably my first programme. I was absolutely petrified. I've got a recording of it somewhere, which for some perverse reason I kept. And it's okay. I think it's fairly remarkable when I hear myself back that my voice seems to be much more high-pitched. I talk far too quickly. And Jeff Griffin was onto that fairly quickly. He's one of the joys of my career at Radio 1 because Derek Chinnery, by coincidence, or deliberately, handed me a producer who was just a dream to work with. We were polar opposites in many of our likes and dislikes in life, which really made it work. We had endless arguments, but no fights. Plenty of arguments, especially about music. I'd say, we've got to play that, it's brilliant. He'd go, you sure? I don't like it. It was fabulous. So there you are. And you're expecting me to say Lennon, which I'm obviously going to say, because it was an honour, a huge privilege and an utter joy to have 3 hours and 20 minutes at the Hit Factory and then another 3 hours over dinner. And I haven't talked to anybody apart from my wife about dinner. Oh, I talked to Julia Baird, John's sister, who I've been lucky enough to meet and who is a really lovely person. But it was private and we had a lot of fun. But I will tell you that we had a pop group at school. Our lead singer, for broadcasters listening to this, was the great newsman Nick Clark, the former host of The World at One. Nick and I grew up with each other. We lived in the same street. He went away to school, to Bradfield College in Reading, and in the school holidays he came home and sang with our group. And I remember at his 50th birthday party, John Humphreys marched up to me and pinned me against the wall. He said, "Right, answer this question. Was the impression of Mick Jagger that Nick Clark did any good?" And I said, "Yes, sir, it was absolutely brilliant." Happy memories, you know, of working around some extraordinary people and in a great industry, which has changed beyond belief. I mean, I decided I'd had enough. I wasn't going to work for the appalling money which is being offered to some people in commercial radio anymore. And thus far, I think I've probably made the right decision. There are people, quite understandably, who believe in the ethic you don't think about retiring until you're at least 70. I admire Tony Blackburn, who is an obsessive, I think, about radio in a wonderful way. He can't get enough of it, and he's still sounding great. My mother said two things to me about this. She wasn't at all happy, Stuart, about me doing what I did. Like so many of my contemporaries at Radio 1, when I arrived in 1978, I'd been to one of them their public schools. I think it says a great deal for the independent schools, the public schools of Britain, that it staffed Radio 1 almost in its entirety when it first started. I mean, I remember my mother saying to me, "You don't go to a public school to become a Radio 1 disc jockey." I said, "Mother, just listen. Tony Blackburn, Millfield, John Peel, Shrewsbury, Ed Stewart, St. Edward's, Oxford, Peter Powell, Uppingham, Noel Edmonds, Brentwood. Do you want me to carry on?" And she just looked at me and went, oh dear." But there you are. It was a joy. It was great fun, and it's wonderful to look back on it.
Andy Peebles, who's died this week at the age of 76. R.I.P. A.P.